This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, a wave of terror from Istanbul to Medina. Hello again, I'm Carol Castillo. In the past week, supporters with suspected or confirmed ties to the so-called Islamic State group have launched deadly strikes in Turkey, Bangladesh, and Iraq. A triple suicide bombing at Istanbul's Ataturk airport killed at least 44 and wounded more than 230. 22 people were killed at a cafe in Dhaka, and at least 250 people were murdered by a car bomb in Baghdad as they were celebrating the final days of Ramadan. Then, bombings rocked three cities across Saudi Arabia, including near the Prophet's Mosque in the holy city of Medina. What are the many factors that contribute to both the timing and location of these attacks? Some analysts say that because the Islamic State, also known as Daesh or ISIS, is losing ground in Iraq and Syria, it is trying to divert attention from its battlefield humiliations by striking beyond its theater of operations. The attack in Baghdad came shortly after Iraqi security forces had recaptured Fallujah from the Islamic State. The attack at the Istanbul airport came after Ankara had decided to intensify efforts to combat ISIS infiltration across the border with Syria, and after its decision to allow Washington to use the Incirlik Air Base to launch airstrikes against the militant group in Syria. The other attacks, whether in Bangladesh or Saudi Arabia, may have been inspired rather than directed by ISIS through online propaganda. IS has succeeded in radicalizing young, disaffected Muslims around the world from the United States to Bangladesh. We'll explore the various factors that propelled the growth or appeal of Daesh, even as it loses territory in Iraq and Syria, with our distinguished analysts, who are no strangers to these VOA microphones. Blaise Michtal is the director of the Bipartisan Policy Center's National Security Program, and Nuseiba Yunus is resident senior fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Carol.
Thanks.
Well, Blaise Michtal, let me begin with you. Let's first start with what, if anything, do you think all these attacks have in common in terms of the timing? And also, we need to distinguish between the so-called directed attacks and these ones that we consider inspired.
I do think it's more interesting to try to draw the distinctions between these attacks than lump them all together. And so I think you want to think about differently what are the relationships that ISIS has towards Turkey, towards Iraq, towards Saudi Arabia. All those are very different. And then also, why might it be trying to have people strike as far away as Bangladesh? What is sort of the global goal here?
How do you see it, Nuseiba, the distinctions, but at the same time, the interesting coincidence that all of them have taken place within almost the span of 10 days?
I think something that ISIS tries to do is to really take credit for a very wide range of attacks that it does not necessarily have responsibility for, and that it has not actually played much of a role in orchestrating. And that's why it set up this very loose franchise arrangement where it encourages lone wolves around the world to declare themselves as affiliates of ISIS and to conduct whatever terror attack they would like to, such as the hostage situation that we saw in Dhaka in Bangladesh. And I think in some ways, when we see this as part of a coordinated campaign or as part of some kind of systematic attempt by ISIS to give the world some message or another, I think we give ISIS more credit than it's due here. In fact, what's happening is a variety of actors in these different countries are often trying to pursue their own goals and are using the ISIS logo to gain attention, to brand themselves as heroes, to put themselves in a narrative of a broader religious goal that may not necessarily be reflected in their actual relationship with ISIS.
Well, we'll explore that point in a moment. But first, let's start with the attack in Turkey, Blaise. As you well know, there have been at least 8 major terror attacks in Turkey over the last year or so. What is your takeaway from this most recent attack in Turkey?
Well, I think it's actually quite different than what we've seen going on in Turkey over the last year. First of all, of those 8 attacks, we have to distinguish some were suspected to have been perpetrated by ISIS. Some were carried out by Kurdish militants within Turkey. But of the ISIS attacks that we've seen in Turkey so far, most of them have not been against Turkey itself, so to say. They mostly targeted Kurds within Turkey because Kurds are the primary force fighting ISIS within Syria. And there's sort of this assumption that Kurds in Syria are the same as Kurds in Turkey. So we've seen bombings against border towns right on the Syrian border where Kurds live. We've seen Kurdish rallies bombed in Ankara. And we've also seen ISIS attacks against foreigners, against German tourists in Istanbul, against Israeli tourists as well. So this is the first ISIS attack that we can say is really targeting Turkey itself. But why is the important question?
Correct.
And I think the common narrative that this is because Turkey is fighting ISIS is really not a very persuasive one. Turkey joined the anti-ISIS coalition a year ago, last July. So if that's the reason, if that's because they allowed the United States to use the Incirlik Air Base, why has it taken a year for ISIS to attack Turkey and Turkish interests themselves while they've been attacking other interests within Turkey? That doesn't make sense. I think what you're seeing is twofold. One, obviously, ISIS is being pushed in both Syria and Iraq and is looking to strike outside of the territory. But I think they're also trying to spread destabilizing tendencies across the region. What they've capitalized on in Iraq and Syria are civil war, civil conflicts. And you have Turkey that is actually starting to be embroiled in its own civil war with the Kurds. And I think what they see is an opportunity to help push Turkey even further over the edge and to create within Turkey the same new ungoverned spaces and opportunities for them to exploit that they used in Syria and Iraq. So I think they're playing a bigger game, have a longer strategic objective in Turkey than we've maybe realized thus far.
Just a quick follow-up. Some analysts and some policymakers have accused Turkey, the government, of having a loose border with Syria, allowing ISIS fighters come across the border. Is that true? Because ISIS is no more of an ally to Turkey than is the government of Bashar al-Assad. So my perception was that rebel fighters more affiliated with the mainstream groups who are fighting Assad and also ISIS have been coming across. But have they been infiltrated by ISIS fighters coming across the border to Turkey?
Almost certainly. And so just to take Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan at his word, the number one threats to Turkey are Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian Kurds and Turkish Kurds together, and ISIS is a distant third. He does not see ISIS as the same level of threat that the United States sees it as. And because of that, or maybe because they have been worried about inciting ISIS violence, Turkey has tacitly allowed ISIS to really grow and exploit Turkey as a logistical hub for its operations in Syria.
So sort of turning a blind eye, as you said, not prioritizing them.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So we've seen Turkey, I think, actively support extremist groups in Syria like al-Nusra, like al-Sham and others. With ISIS, I think it's been more of a tacit, we'll leave you alone to do your thing. And to see that, you only need to look at the designation of ISIS terrorists, ISIS fighters that the U.S. Treasury has put out. Of the 25 or so individuals within ISIS that the Treasury Department has named specifically, more than half of those are designated for operating within Turkey. Yet they're not individuals that, even though they're listed as terrorists by the U.S., that Turkey has tried to arrest or roll up or interrogate in any way.
Turning to you, Nusaybe, for your take on what happened in Turkey recently, and how do you see Ankara's role now vis-a-vis combating ISIS and the fact that, you know, up until more recently, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president, has prioritized the fight against Bashar al-Assad, who many see as just the other side of the coin of ISIS because his very presence in Syria, many argue, helped perpetuate the growth of ISIS.
It's possible that in the aftermath of the Ankara bombings that we'll see a continued shift in Turkish foreign policy. We've already seen some indications with Turkey mending its relationship with Israel after years of diplomatic freeze, and also making strong overtures to Russia. And I think that there's a gradual realization in Turkey, and this has partly been aided in some way by the change of personnel with the new prime minister. So now what we're seeing is some reassessing. Ultimately, Erdogan and the Turkish establishment believed very early on that stability in Syria would only be achieved through the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad. And it's a valid argument, and it's an argument that a lot of people have made very persuasively. But several years after the beginning of the uprising, the conflict in Syria has morphed into something else altogether. And I think Turkey is finally beginning to wake up to the level of threat that ISIS poses to it and is going to continue, I believe, to reassess its policy towards Syria and towards allowing extremist groups to operate in its territory.
And at the same time, do you think it will reassess its relationship with the Kurds? Just as early as last year, there was a potential peace process going on. But once again, you have this difference of opinion between Ankara and Washington, whereas Ankara, at least under President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, seeing the Syrian Kurds, who are the U.S.'s most important ally against the Islamic State in Syria, seeing them as a greater threat than the so-called Islamic State. Do you think that will start to change and perhaps a different policy vis-a-vis both Turkish Kurds and Syrian Kurds?
It would make a lot of sense for the Turkish state to reassess its Kurdish policy. The continued war between the Turkish military and Kurdish fighters is very counterproductive, is extremely destabilizing, and makes Turkey very vulnerable to extremism and continued violence and instability. Unfortunately, what I see is actually Turkey very much locked in this conflict. I have not seen any indication of de-escalation, of a move towards a peace process. In fact, what we've seen back in the rhetoric of a zero-sum war against the Kurds, as if there is some kind of military defeat that's actually possible in this scenario, which there absolutely isn't. Eventually, this conflict will have to be sorted out at the negotiating table. And it's a real tragedy for Turkey and very short-sighted that the conflict is not being diffused earlier.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Blaise Mistal, he's director of the Bipartisan Policy Center's National Security Program, and Nuseiba Yunus, she's resident senior fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. We're discussing the implications of the spate of terror attacks around the world, either inspired or perpetrated by the so-called Islamic State group. And here's a shout-out to Paul Okech from Nairobi, Kenya. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Blaise Mistal. Let's go now to the terrible car bomb in Iraq, in Baghdad. Again, talk about the varying reasons, in your view, for this attack coming on the heels of retaking Fallujah from IS, that is the Iraq Security Forces.
Of course, I think that the ouster of ISIS from Fallujah is the immediate context for this happening. But I think it's, again, to go to ISIS's overall strategy, which is to try to destabilize the regional order and the political order structures that have existed in the region for a long time. I think in this regard, ISIS is really quite different than Al-Qaeda and has brought about a strategic innovation that really requires trying to drum up further sectarian conflict between the different religions and sects in the region, and that's what we're seeing them do in Iraq.
How do you see it, Nuseiba Yunus, what happened in Baghdad?
Well, something that ISIS has long tried to do is to expose the cracks in Iraq's security infrastructure and to terrify the citizens and residents of Baghdad and in other government-held parts of Iraq, to show that the government is incapable, actually, of securing the lives of regular Iraqis, and to show that they continue to remain a viable force that can prevent stability in Iraq, even beyond their territory being retaken. Something that has been very interesting in the aftermath of this terrible bombing in Qarada, where over 250 Iraqis were killed, is that there has been a great deal of popular anger against the government. So Prime Minister Abadi saw his motorcade pelted with stones and people were jeering at him. There's also been a preliminary investigation that's shown not only that this truck bomb made its way from Diyala into Baghdad past checkpoints where it was not searched, most likely due to bribery and corruption, but also the building that was attacked was not built to building codes, was extremely flammable and very vulnerable, and that Iraq's firefighting services ran out of water very quickly and couldn't have the capacity to handle the fire. So actually, attacks such as these are very successful in highlighting the very wide range of ways in which the Iraqi government is absolutely failing to serve the needs of its people.
And in terms of any political changes, which on this very program you have spoken about before, the need for de-Ba'athification, the need for incorporating more Sunnis in the army and civilian life, Prime Minister al-Abadi seems to be somewhat paralyzed. Will greater political changes be afoot?
So the problem with bombings like this, and I suspect this is very clear to ISIS, is that it pushes the Iraqi people to support ever more extreme Shiite politicians who use this uncompromising rhetoric and who talk in very black and white terms about the responsibility of Sunnis for these kinds of actions. And so something we've seen is the resignation of the Minister of Interior, Mohammed Rabban, and he runs the Interior Ministry as a member of the Badr organization, which is one of Iraq's notorious militia groups. Him having tendered his resignation is actually a political ploy. What he's doing is he's saying that the Prime Minister is preventing the Ministry of Interior from doing its job because the government is not allowing Badr, essentially, through the Ministry of Interior, to completely control security in Baghdad. And so he's making a bid for ever more responsibility over security for his own particular militia group, which is something that might end up happening.
Which would, of course, just aggravate the problem even more.
Yeah, it would make it extremely difficult for US and coalition troops to operate from Baghdad. It could potentially make the situation in Baghdad very dangerous for Sunni civilians.
Well, turning back to you, Blaise Mishtal, let's talk more about the roots of the problem, that is the various grievances that propel and help foster the growth of ISIL. We have a festering problem in Syria. We have now the United States looking even to coordinate with Russia, who is really backing Bashar al-Assad, who's seen as part of the problem. I mean, to what extent do you see this festering war in Syria as one of the root causes? What other thoughts do you have? Where do we go from here?
Well, I think the instability and conflict that we see in Syria is merely a situation that is being exploited by long-standing core of really extremist ideologues. If you look at the bombing in Istanbul, it was carried out by people coming from the former Soviet Union, an ethnic Chechen from Russia, a Kyrgyz, and an Uzbek, but it was coordinated by Ahmed Chataev, known as Ahmed the One-Armed, who's a veteran of the Chechen War. So, I mean, this is an Islamist fighter going back 25 years. So these are long-standing networks of people who have been fighting for a long time and are finding their way now and finding a place in Syria to continue that fight. So you have that base there. Then you have the ethno-sectarian grievances that are being inflamed by this conflict, as Musabaya was saying, the idea that the Shiites in Iraq will not take care of the Sunnis, the fact that the Kurds feel they need to carve out their own spaces. So these are being inflamed and are driving the tensions further. And in fact, I think really lack of U.S. vision and leadership here to try to resolve this ethno-sectarian side of the conflict first is helping ISIS. And on top of that, you have the allure of heroism and adventure that is drawing people to fight for ISIS and is drawing people to carry out attacks in the name of ISIS. And I think as the Dhaka attack shows, this idea that we have that extremist ideology or violent extremism can be boiled down to socioeconomic factors, even though those often have a role to play, but that it's only the disenfranchised or only the poor that are drawn to this because they have no other outlet, is not true. This is a powerful ideology and a powerful idea that people from all walks of life find alluring. In fact, if you look at the studies, most of the attackers on 9/11 were very well-educated people.
Yeah, it's fascinating. There's been some really interesting analysis on this that shows that in some ways, today's rebellion is joining ISIS. For young, often people with very utopian perspectives on how the world could be, people who are just dissatisfied with their lives for a number of different reasons, not necessarily socioeconomic, but just feel frustrated or like their life is a bit directionless. For many of these young people who in a previous era might have gone to fight in the Spanish Civil War are joining this crusade. It's just the latest in a series of global ideologies, you know, similar to the allure that communism had, even as Stalin was massacring his own people and sending them to gulags. The point is, sometimes there are these catch-all ideologies that offer this just extraordinary utopian vision of what a new society and a new world order could look like. And it's the way they express their rebellion today.
Well, back to you as we close, Blaise Mishtal, because I've heard also, analysts say that radical Islam isn't really the cause for perpetration of violence and barbarism, but rather it's an excuse. So we have that. You have, as you said earlier, disintegration of, you know, governments, bad governance. You have the Shia-Sunni tensions exacerbated now, the rise of Iran hegemony in the region, which of course is irritating, and that's to put it mildly, you know, Saudi Arabia and other Sunni Gulf states. And the U.S. role seen by some is not helping at all or too hands off. And then we have the presidential race. You have people like Donald Trump saying we need to ban Muslims. Some saying that this is exactly a playing into the hands of ISIS. That's exactly what they want to do, perpetuate this sense of victimization of Muslims around the world. So how do we respond in a constructive way in addition to so many policies that need to be modified?
Well, I do think the response needs to become more comprehensive. I think there's a danger when we talk about the problem in Syria being ISIS and not seeing the broader conflict and the grievances that have been inflamed there. I think there's a problem when we talk about our goal is now countering violent extremism as if we're going to be able to identify just these singular individuals that they're thinking about committing a violent act and stop them. There is most certainly a connection between the violence and the ideology that inspires it. And I think we need to think more broadly about how we begin to try to change that ideology, or at least the spread of that ideology through social media and through the fact that ISIS can broadcast out of Raqqa and Syria and not necessarily show the barbarity of daily life there, but spread this ideological vision of come join us and come start a new world order with us. And I think we have to recognize that a lot of that built on extremism, perhaps not violent extremism, but extremist ideologies that are perpetuated by existing structures in the Middle East, and the fact that maybe they're not violent, but there's a lot of radical beliefs that are spread by Saudi Arabia, but then also live underground in places like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And we have to find ways to confront those and see those as part of the problem that is feeding into the violence.
And the last word to you, Nusaybe Yunus, because Blaise makes a good point. You have this ideology, interpretation of Islam in Saudi Arabia, Wahhabism, which has been institutionalized, but perhaps we see the roots of it in how ISIS explains what it's doing. Of course, taking it to a terrible extreme and using violence. So that's a problem as well. And how do we counter this without alienating our so-called allies, one of whom is Saudi Arabia?
I mean, it's an interesting problem because, of course, the royal family in Saudi Arabia turn around to us and ask us, how do you think we should counter this without alienating our religious class and inspiring our own citizens to overthrow us and replace us with a much more religiously extreme regime than the one that we offer? The Saudis have played with fire for a long time in trying to shore up their legitimacy by using this bargain with the religious elites. That's really the basis of their position in Saudi society. And they're trying to do that whilst also simultaneously trying to prevent the worst excesses of those elites. And the sad truth is today that many, many Saudi civilians support the belief structures that are advocated by these clerics. So we're looking at a long-term process of changing the education system, of slowly trying to change the way in which religion is taught in schools without triggering a revolution in the short term that could leave us with an even worse regime than the one we see today.
And quickly, one last word about Syria, to the extent it has morphed into this terrible civil war, started as a peaceful uprising, and now you have Bashar al-Assad back to the hilt by Iran, Shia militias, both from Iran, of course, and Hezbollah, and now Russia. Even though it ostensibly says it's fighting terrorism, actually it's there to prop up Bashar al-Assad, who, of course, one could argue is a main driver of the Islamic State. How much of a factor is Bashar al-Assad in keeping alive the so-called Islamic State, which we've been talking about throughout this program?
I believe that Bashar al-Assad and the mass murder that he's inflicted on the Syrian population has been one of the greatest radicalizing forces of this generation. And ultimately, people aren't inspired to go halfway across the world to start killing people for absolutely no reason. It starts with anger at injustice. And often we forget that's where it starts. But yeah, this all starts with Bashar al-Assad in many ways.
Now, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Blaise Michetal. He's director of the Bipartisan Policy Center's National Security Program, and Nuseiba Yunus, resident senior fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. Thanks so much for coming in, sharing your insights.
Thanks for a fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced here in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Thomas Blondet. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.